Well, in fact, perhaps I prepared for the wrong talk because I've been told by Victor, who now skips this talk, that it should be a very it should be a very pedagogical talk. So I actually wanted to tell you lots of basics about the anion models, and then towards the end just say how to. So I was basically going to set up the language, which is kind of useful in thinking about various experiments, in particular interferometric experiments. But what I'm going to say is highly original and definitely not my work. In fact, it's kind of inspired by what I learned from Alexei Kitaev and John Preskill, and lots of it can be found in in John Preskill's lectures online. And I'm not claiming even that is original. So lots of that is actually scattered in math books, which I did not read. So I, so John Preskill's lectures are available on HTTP. What? Can you tell I'm slipping?
Oh, that's great.
Caltech EDU, and then it's at Preskill. Topological PS, and another good reference would be Alexei Kitaev's long paper from last summer, which I don't have immediate reference to, but it's easy to find. It's anion models and beyond, which you can find online, and there is an appendix that deals with anion models in all the gory details. So I'll just try to recoup some of that stuff. Oh yeah, I should also mention, I mean, other people work, for example, another useful reference would be paper by Frolov and Gabbiani. And as I said, lots of that stuff is actually in the math books, and I can't even attempt to cite all of them. So basically what I'm going to talk about is anion models and eventually how to detect anions and how to calculate things about their braiding. But basically, anions themselves, of course, come when one starts thinking about exchanging particles in two spatial dimensions. And of course, if we look in two dimensions and attempt to exchange two identical particles, we can immediately realize that that can be done in two ways. So this is what we would call the exchange R, and then you would also have the inverse of that, R to the minus one. And the difference, the reason why two spatial dimensions are much more interesting than three from this point of view, is that in two dimensions, these two operations are not identical to each other. While in three spatial dimensions, of course, the difference between them is moot because you can continuously rotate the plane in which you exchange the particles, and one will be immediately mapped into the other. And so as a result, in three spatial dimensions, you immediately get to the conclusion that R squared should be equal to 1, which leaves you with only two eigenvalues, plus or minus 1, hence bosons and fermions. In two spatial dimensions, these two operations are not the same, and therefore you can have more possibilities than you would in three dimensions. So mathematically speaking, you can say that if you have n particles, then in three dimensions, all you have is, if you start exchanging them, all you have is a permutation group. In two spatial dimensions, you actually have a braid group, which is, so if I think of these exchanges, if I put time along the vertical axis, I can think of exchanging two particles as sort of creating this little braid. And a braid group is actually generated by, so this would be R, and this would be R to the minus one. And a braid group is just the object, it's just a way of drawing lines are the actual generators of the group, of the break group for n particles, and lines are all given by something like this, where you simply exchange particle number I and I plus 1. So this is R, I, etc., etc. And the rest of them just sort of follow along the straight lines. So once again, what I'm thinking about now is the evolution of particles in time. And what happens here, I just simply exchange the two particles together. And by stacking this picture, I can generate the entire group. So this group is much richer than the permutation group. And representations of that group actually can be used to classify various anions. So a few more words about this group, the break group. This is the break group. So it has obvious commutation relations. Well, one of them is completely obvious. That is, if you take two pairs of particles that are completely disjoint, then it doesn't really matter in which order you perform these exchanges, which means that, well, maybe I should put it here. So R I R J is equal to R J R I, provided that the two braids actually sufficiently far from each other, that is, the distance between them is more than one. Now, there is one slightly less trivial relation, which is easy to draw, and then I can write what it is, and that what happens when you actually mess up with the neighboring braids. So let me do this. So you see what happens. I first, so let this to be particle I plus 1, I plus 2. And so this braid can be written as RI plus 1, RI. So I first exchange the I and the I plus first particle. Then I exchange I plus first and the next one. And then once again, I exchange the new I and I first particle. And this is equal to, and it's obvious visually, but let me just attempt to draw it once again. So it's right. So this should be the case. Right. So you can see that all that happens here is that, well, we can think of it in different ways, but you can just trace that you kind of moved the back line and the background to the left, but you didn't really change anything about the particular way you break these lines. And of course, this can be written as Ri plus 1, Ri plus 1. And so that's the relation for the neighboring operations.
What do you mean by sufficiently far away? I mean, what is the meaning of 1 here? Like, is there some length scale which tells you that it has to be bigger than such a length scale?
Yeah, so all that tells me is that, for example, if I exchange this particle, so which one did I?
Carol, I think the answer to that is that those are integers.
So I is an integer.
Can be
But I mean, let me just draw it. Let me just draw it. So if I deal with these two exchanges, one here and one here, so this is I plus 1, 5 + 2, that it's already sufficiently far away. So it doesn't matter which one I do first.
I can draw it, you know, put them very close enough. What I mean is that physically, it's a positional particle, right?
Yeah.
If I'm dealing in a continuum system, then positional particle can be sufficiently close and sufficiently far away.
Sure.
So which means sufficiently far away, then what?
That
some length scale.
Yeah, so
really on a lattice. Well, lattice spacing will just be a smallest length scale.
So what I need to do is I need to project them onto a two-dimensional space and then order them in any way I want, and then.
I think the confusion is that this is much simpler than physics. you're looking for a length scale, and Kirill is talking about the integers. And two integers are sufficiently far apart if their difference is 2.
Right, you know.
So it's a mathematical.
Yeah, so all I'm doing so far, I'm just describing this mathematical object called the braid group. And, you know, going from the actual particles to the braid group is, you know, as I said, you can always do that by sort of looking from the side, ordering them in any way you wish. And but, you know, that's sort of an extra step that I'm not discussing at this point even. All I'm doing is just describing the properties of this braid group, and in fact, for no reason whatsoever, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually describe the properties of anions, which are the representations, which are classified according to the representations of this group. And well, just one comment that, of course, what I can always do is I can choose one-dimensional representations. That is, I can associate just a pure phase to these exchange operations. So in this case, Ri would be just equal to the, associated to the e to the I theta, where theta is some statistical angle. And the inverse will come with the inverse. And these are abelian anions. That's not what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm going to talk about today is high-dimensional representations, that is, when these exchanges are actually represented by the matrices. And, matrices don't commute, so typically anyway. That's why the anions are called non-abelian.
When I minus j equal to 1.
Yeah, when I minus j is equal to 1, that's this case.
Oh, that's the case, okay.
So that, if they're sufficiently far apart, at least two lines apart, then you know you can stick as many junk in the middle as you want, they clearly commute.
Okay.
But if you try to do any closer, then
a different relation.
Yeah, it's a different relation. So you have two relations, one for the generators that are far apart, and one for the two neighboring generators.
Can I ask a question? So for the one-dimensional representations, the difference between the braiding group and the permutation group is that for permutation, it's either plus 1 or minus 1.
Right.
But this is a continuous variable.
Right.
Are there actually interesting non-abelian representations of the permutation group, which are interested to identical particles for them?
This is what's called parastatistics sometimes.
Oh, that's just parastatistics?
It's just parastatistics.
Right. Right.
Higher dimensional representation of the permutation group.
But I don't think anything particularly interesting comes out of it. So, I mean, yes, sure, you can work with the high dimensional representations, but people have tried and nothing interesting came out.
Okay, there's a paper which might be interesting, which is a pretty rare to find. So Nick Reed wrote a paper at this point, which is you go from permutation group and you go a little bit more.
Oh, that's what he was talking about, the projective?
Yeah, you can add projective replication. Mm-hmm. And you get, you know, high-dimensional projective replication of the permutation group. And there are still no. There's a very subtle locality problem, so.
I'm aware of the paper. I'm not aware of the actual project. But, okay, so let me, at this point, abstract myself even further from physics. And just sort of introduce you to the mathematical, if you wish, description of anion models, which comes out to be, so at first it might seem very abstract, but it comes very handy if you actually want to calculate some things, in particular if you think about things like, interferometers and stuff like this. So I'll try to actually have some flashbacks to physics to help you understand what I'm talking about. But at this point, I just want to, so I don't need this anymore, so I'm going to erase this. I'm going to sort of define some anion models. And I'll introduce lots of jargon that is used in this field, and hopefully, you know, I'm not certain if there is any value in that, but maybe it will help you understand some of the words that you guys hear in the other talks, and which, as I said, is jargon coming from mathematical physics, but is used now in various talks. So anion models, known also to mathematicians as unitary braided tensor categories, but you don't need to worry about that particular term. So basically, what are the things that define an anion model from the point of view of a mathematician? First of all, there is a finite set of labels. So C is a set of labels. Which or anion charges. So these are just the types of anions that I can have in my physical system. And if you want to have, you know, so just to keep you connected to physics, one example that you might have heard about in this workshop would be this Pfaffian state or unpaired Majorana modes. So the same. So in that theory, there are actually three types of particles. So this whole set C, you know, consists of three labels that are routinely called 1, sigma, and psi. In a second, I'll tell you what these are. But in principle, these are the three charges or labels or whatever you want to call them. These are not electric charges. They just describe what kind of anions I have in my system. So this is just to keep something in mind. And what we have is we have a fusion algebra for these labels, and it's commutative and it's associative. So what it means, if I take two anions and combine them together, I can always break this into so what this tells me, this is the so-called fusion rules. This tells me what happens when I combine anion A and anion B. So the result may be a superposition, if you wish, of other anionic charges labeled here as C. NABC is always an integer, can be zero. Now, but it doesn't have to be only 0 or 1. In principle, it can be more than 1 if there are several channels of fusing anion A and B into a particle of type C. Now,
can I ask you? You write this 1 sigma per psi. Is this the same thing as the IC model, the primary field of IC model?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I can treat
I was just about to say that, in fact, you can think of this as nothing but operator product expansion.
I can think A and B as a primary operator.
Yes.
In IC model.
Yes.
We'll take one example.
Yes. Yes. So that's in fact, these are indeed the primary fields of the easing model.
Okay. So that's like a fusion rule.
So fusion rule is what you would know from the conformal field theory as operator product expansion.
Okay.
It tells you that you combine, and in fact it has the same meaning, because it doesn't really mean that I'm trying to physically fuse two anions together or do some serious violence to them. All that means, as seen from afar, the property of the combination of these two anions can be thought of as sort of another anion that that exists there. And since you brought this easing conformal theory, which is what we have in the case of a Pfaffian state, for example, I can actually spell out what these fusion rules are. So perhaps I'll do it in a second. So these are integer numbers. Now, One thing is that if all these numbers are equal to 1, then the theory is actually abelian. However, if there is a possibility of fusing two particles and getting more than one, sorry, I take it back. If there is only one term in the sum for every single fusion relation you can write down, then the theory is abelian. But if you can get a sort of non-trivial sum for two particles, then the theory is actually non-abelian. But before I sort of give you an example, let me mention a few properties. So there is a unique trivial vacuum charge, one, that's this one, such that you always fuse, so, you know, NA1C is just delta AC. So whatever you fuse with this charge, you just get your charge back. Now, the fact that it's often called vacuum doesn't really mean it's a vacuum. It's, you know, it, for example, it can be a charged boson in the real physical world. What it means is that by attaching this particle to sort of any other anion, you don't change its braiding properties. Well, so far I didn't start talking about braiding properties, but you don't change, for example, any fusion properties. All right? So vacuum should be...
just the boson.
Yeah.
Vacuum, boson is not the vacuum. Anyway. In this algebra.
Well, in this algebra. So, all I was saying is that very often it's referred to as a vacuum particle. But you have to be careful about what you mean when you say the word vacuum. It may well carry electric charge, for example. So it's definitely anything but a vacuum.
Actually, how general is this? This is some particular class of animals.
This is the most general description
the
of
most general description.
Yeah, this is the most general description that is sort of, as I said, so far I'm just quoting from what mathematicians know, you know, or think about this as actually dealing with the conformal field theory. The two are actually very, very closely related.
Actually, I'm confused about one thing. So you're saying that this fusion rule corresponds to the operator product expansion. What does this integer n, if it turns out to be 2, not 1, where does that show up in the operator product expansion? Or how does it show up in the operator product expansion?
So I cannot on the fly think about conformal field theory a way you would.
I think you
have two different. Do you know?
I think yes. Just take some SU three high level.
Uh-huh.
We'll get it too. But I think I should say that it's not completely true that they are the same. So if you really want to think about conformal field theory, if you have an ABC, you really should think about this as a primary or descendant. It's not. If AB, so if A appears on the right hand side, the A not necessarily has to be primary. It can be a descendant of A on the left. So there's a famous theory, the Fibonacci theory. It's an open question, can you reproduce this with the conformal field theory, which has two primary, one is the trivial one, the other, there's a single primary, which when you fuse the primary, you get one plus primary back. So it's still open. So this is slightly more general than conformal field theory in this sense. Actually, there's another, there's something not chiral theory, which is we don't have any conformal field theory. So it's very close related, but it's not quite the same. Mm-hmm. Now there are lots of twos. So if you really go to complicated theory, you can get lots of NIJK, which is any, as large as you want.
Okay.
If you just check, there's a paper by a physicist, a Gebner and somebody, who has a list of all the conformal field theory up to, I think, 6 labels or something. And there's a lot of theory there have twos.
All right. Thanks. Okay, so there is also a unique conjugated charge for every charge A in such a way that if you fuse, so a bar conjugated charge, in such a way that if you fuse this A and A bar, you'll just get a vacuum charge back. So you can think of this sort of antiparticle, if you wish. Although in many theories, it will be equivalent to the particle itself. So so for the, I can say that this is the case when AB1 is actually equal to delta BA bar. So there is only one label B that that you can fuse A with, so that you get a vacuum charge. All right. So now, as I mentioned, the theory is non-abelian if the following is true, that sum over C and A, B, C is greater than 1 for some choice of charges A and B. And just to sort of put some meat on this bones, let me go back to this theory and write down what the fusion relations are, and that will probably help you visualize things. So basically, in fact, the only non-trivial fusion relation, anything fused with 1 obviously gives the particle back. So I'm not even bothering to write them down. Now, the relations that are non-trivial are the relations that come from fusing particle of type sigma with itself, particle of type sigma with particle of type psi, and of course psi. And the relations are that this is sigma, this is actually 1, and this is 1 plus psi. And the fact that this is a non-abelian theory is hidden in this line. There is more than one fusion channel for this particular types of particles. Well, to put even more meat on these bones, let me actually mention the relation of that to the unpaired Majorana modes. So you can think of these sigmas as unpaired Majoranas. And then, of course, one would correspond. So if you have two Majorana modes and you combine them together, you get a full-fledged fermionic mode, which can be either empty or occupied. So if it's empty, that's 1. If it's occupied, that psi. So psi is a fermion. 1 is the absence of a fermion, if you wish, it's a boson. And that's what this is. So if you pair an unpaired Majorana mode with anything else, you actually get back an unpaired Majorana mode. You take two fermions and pair them together, you actually get a boson. So it's just restatement of the physics of unpaired Majorana modes in the language of these fields.
I was confused because it's a sigma, you're supposed to understand the isomer. Sigma is this spin field.
Yeah.
It has dimension 1/16. How can you treat it as an unpaired Majorana?
So
I just don't know why sigma is a Majorana field.
No, I'm referring to the language that people developed in talking about P plus IP superconductors. So there you have vortices, and each vortex might carry an unpaired Majorana mode. So there is a little confusion, because actually if you look at the easing conformal field theory, this is called Majorana field,
yeah.
This is a spin field.
Yeah.
But I'm not referring to that language now.
Okay.
I'm just making a connection to the subject that was discussed in this workshop previously, and that is what happens in P plus IP superconductors.
Oh, okay.
And in P plus IP superconductors, you can have vortices, and these vortices have zero modes inside them, which are actually unpaired Majorana modes.
Okay.
And these are sort of,
I understand.
In the language that is completely unrelated to the of the easing CFT, these are the unpaired Majorana modes, and that these are the two fusion channels for
them. Yeah, the form stays the same. Looks like
the
fusion.
Okay, so, there is another famous case that you might have heard about, which is Fibonacci particles. Fibonacci anions, there are only two types of those, two labels, so it's even simpler, and the only non-trivial fusion relation, so the two labels are 1 and epsilon, and the only non-trivial diffusion relation is epsilon. All right. So there is a way of thinking about fusing these particles, which is sometimes very handy, and that is called Bratzeli diagrams, which helps visualize what happens as you fuse these particles. And so let me just draw the Bratzeli diagram. So it's really a way of trying to find what are the possible outcomes of adding n particles together. And what you should be thinking about is something you would do if you were adding spins. If you add spin halves, for example, if you start from spin zero and add one spin a half, the only possible outcome is one half. You add another spin a half, you can either go back to zero or you can get to one. You add another spin a half, and then sort of the diagram keeps branching like this. So in principle, you can think of this as a way of finding all possible outcomes of adding n spin halves, where n is how many spins you added this way. So this is an example of a Bratzeli diagram that you all understand. Now, you can also do Bratzeli diagrams for those models. And in fact, this model is also known, closely related to SU2 level 2 model. And the fact that it's SU2 level 2 simply means that you take the Bratzeli diagram for adding spins, which is unrestricted SU2, and simply erase everything below the second step. So what you have then is simply a Bratzeli diagram that looks like this. So the point is that if you add spin half to zero, you can get a half. You can still get sort of one or zero here, but you cannot go above one in as you keep adding. So you just put a constraint. So now, of course, looking back at the fusion rules, you realize that this corresponds to just adding sigma particles. So this is a sigma particle. This is the psi 1, sigma psi 1, etc.
How does that look for the Fibonacci thing?
So Fibonacci is actually adding spin 1s rather than spin halves. And you don't allow spin 2 outcome. So you associate this with spin 1, and as you add two spin 1s, normally you have 0, 1, or 2. Here you throw out 2.
Also,
it's
straight line and line down.
Yeah. Now, let me go even more mathematical and introduce fusion spaces. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a vector space VABC, which is associated with actually fusing particles of type A and B to the particle of type C. And the dimension of this space is going to be N A, B, C. And in fact, all theories which I'm considering are, over there. N, A, B, C is always one. So that means that, in fact, these fusion spaces are one-dimensional. And of course, there is also a splitting space. So this is a fusion. This is a fusion space. And there is a dual splitting space, VCAB, which is, of course, it describes the way of splitting particles C into particles A and B. There are vectors that live in these vector spaces, which I will describe. Denote as A, B, C. That simply says, so this vector belongs to the BC, AB. So this is the vector in the splitting space of anion C into two particles A, B, and C. And this is going to be And in a second, I'm actually going to, instead of writing all this vector, I'm going to introduce diagrams for drawing them. It's much, much simpler. So before I do this, let me actually mention something, and then I'll draw it. So what if I'm fusing together three anions rather than two? So you could imagine that the fusion space of splitting space of three anions A, B, C should be a, you know, I should be able to use the combination of these . So what this tells me is that if I'm splitting an anion D into A, B, and C parts, I can actually do it by first splitting anion D into something, a particle E and C, and then breaking a particle E into A and D. But on the other hand, I should also be allowed to do it the other way around, and that is what this tells me is that I first break my anion D into A and F, and then I break F into B and C. And of course, there should be a relation between these two. So the two spaces should be isomorphic. And in fact, a vector from one of these spaces should be representable as the sum of the vectors in the other space. And it's done with the help of so-called F symbols or 6J symbols. Otherwise known as Clebsch-Gordan coefficients if you actually deal with spins. So, but I'm not going to write them down, I'm just going to draw diagrams that that describe this. So basically what I need to do is I want to associate pictures to these diagrams. And the pictures are fairly simple. So what I'm going to associate to a vector of this kind is going to be a diagram that looks like this. So what this tells me is that I have an anion C that can be split into A and B. What I have here is the inverse of that diagram, that's a fusion of A and B C. In principle, I might, if this space is more than one dimensional, I need a label, but I don't care about this, at least for the purpose of today's talk. So these are the diagrams that I associate with these vectors, and now I can actually start drawing. For example, the F symbols can be easily, so, you know, which establish this isomorphism between these two spaces, can be drawn in the following form. Did I erase them?
Good.
Sorry. So let me just do graphically what this equation says. It simply tells me that if I start by start with the anion of type D, as I mentioned there, and I first break it into the anion E and C, and then I break anion E into A and B. So, is it too high? A, B, C, right. So this is the element of this vector space and represents how to get to A, B, and C from D. Now, what I have here is actually D, which first breaks into A and F, so this is A, this is F, and then I split F into B and C.
And you're also one that's going to create B first?
Sure, you can do that, but I'm just going to introduce the... You can always rework your F symbols to do whatever you want. But so this is equal to sum over f, f, d, a, d, c, e, f. So it's a huge matrix with six coefficients, which allows you to go from one picture to the other. Now, in any theory that we might want to consider, lots of these entries are actually zeros. So in fact, the actual pictures look much simpler than and just sort of all possibilities of summing over six indices. All right, so there is one, so these matrices F cannot be anything. They actually heavily constrained. And if I produce the picture, so there is a consistency condition, which is called pentagon equation. Pentagon equation arises when you actually want to fuse four rather than three particles together, or alternatively split an anion into four parts. So let me just draw it. So 1, 2, 3. So there are two ways I can change this. I can go into this form first. So you see what happened is that I applied the F move here to do this. And then, well, perhaps I should put indices. So so this is U, P, Q, X, Y, Z, W. So this move, so it's the starting and the ending points are, of course, all the same. So I start with U and I end up with X, Y, Z, and W. And then this is done by applying F, U, P, Z, W, where P is this and T is this. Okay, now I can actually go now and move this Y onto this part of the diagram, once again by using my F move. So what will happen is that I will get this X, sorry, X, Y, Z, W. So what you see is that I rearranged the particles. So U, X, Y, Z. So this is S and T, and that is done by using F, U, X, Y, T. On the other hand, I can actually get to the same result by a different route. So what I can do is I can first move down Y to Z, so that would correspond to first building this, Y, Z, X, W. So that's one move. The next move is going to be moving this leg here. So I'm taking this away and attaching it here. So that's X, Y, Z, W, U, U. So perhaps I should fill the blanks. So the blanks, so Q is untouched, but this now changed to R. So this is done with the help of F, X, Y, Z, Q. Now I'm moving here, so it's U, now S, X, Y, Z, so this is R. So this is done with the help of F, U, x of w. And then finally, I'm reattaching z here, and that is this step. And you see why it's called a pentagon equation, because, well, there are five sides to this picture. And so this is a consistency relation that these indices f should satisfy for any theory you can come up with. So in principle, that constrains the types of theories that I allowed in that you might want to consider. Now, naturally, all these coefficients are known for at least the simplest theories that that one might want to consider. But I just wanted to show you how this consistency condition can be applied. Now, of course, at every step you have this huge, you know, matrix multiplication. So actually solving them on the computer turns out to be a rather ugly business. And I know, because two of my collaborators, Parsa Bonderson and Jos Lingerland, are actually in the business of putting that on the computer, just trying to see what kind of theories I, in principle, allowed having certain fusion rules. So just to see if we know all of them. And it turns out it's a horrendous exercise if you actually try to do it on the computer.
So this pentagon equation works for any number of,
well, it's a consistency condition. So the point is that it tells you, it's a constraint on these F matrices that you might want to.
So here I can see that there are five, so, you know, you call it pentagon. But yes. I'm saying that if you begin with U and then fuse into six of them,
yeah,
still have pentagon diagonal.
Yeah, the point is that this is really the only constraint that you have. Mm-hmm. So everything else will follow if this is satisfied.
General,
yeah.
General.
Right. So this is just a consistency condition.
It's very similar to Young-Baxter equation.
No.
Young-Baxter equation is actually something, or at least in this business, Young-Baxter equation is something else, and I'll show you what it is in a second.
Oh.
Young-Baxter equation appears once you actually introduce braiding, and that is what I'm about to do. And I'm already running out of time. That's embarrassing. So another quantity that I wanted to introduce, which is often quoted, is so-called quantum dimension. So what is a quantum dimension? A quantum dimension is actually defined as, so I should just erase this.
Can I ask you another?
Sure.
So when you're adding a spin half, why did you delete all of the other ones? You just said as adding a spin half, you're not dealing with the quantum mechanics, you know.
Yeah, if you're doing quantum mechanics, then you should be marching all the way up.
So how do I delete and why do I delete?
All I'm saying is that this theory has the same Bracelli diagram that you would have if you started with spin ones but restricted the maximum value of total spin.
But if you want to actually, you know, apply this to physics, and I'm sure that you want to restrict, you want to, you know, get rid of all of those states and apply this science sigma and I.
So, you know, what I'm saying is that I don't know how to start with physical spins and get to non-abelian anions so there is no simple way of starting from physical spins and saying no, they can't add to that value. So all I'm saying is that the naive properties of the models look very much like that for the spins, with the exception that you actually chop off the, this is where the notion of level comes in. So level tells you where you chop off the summation for your spins.
I guess the one way to maybe start from physics is that if you look at the unrestricted case, which is any angular momentum, that's a consequence of the angular momentum commutation relation. But if you modify that commutation relation a little bit, you can actually eliminate some of the states.
But which means that you need some strong constraint coming from some interactions.
No, that's not a constraint. It's really just a consequence of the algebra.
I mean, the physical system one can think of actually is the nickel crystal. If you take two high summation come together, you can even annihilate. So high the collision rule of the defect actually is it's basically controlled by the Ising algebra you're showing. It's basically Ising algebra.
No, I understand that there are physical systems where you can have particles that, you know, after all, I just talked about quantum Hall system where that happens.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that I don't know how to interpret this as a single quantum mechanical spin and then, you know, somehow enforce this constraint with spins. I know that the excitations that obey these rules appear as quasi-particles in other physical theories, but all I'm saying is that it looks like spin, smells like spins, but I don't know how to get there just studying from, you know, from spins.
Related to the first question about the discrimination or the vortices, not the vortices in the condensate. But typically vortices are quite heavy objects, almost classical. So this is one, although we have a similar fusion rule, but in this classical vortex,
I'm just referring to the isolated algebra.
You know what I mean?
That liquid aspect of
In the liquid crystal, we also have similar defects. Can we also have?
Well, I think the issue is whether you can end up in a superposition of
yeah,
two.
Superposition
of
is
two. So that's because if you have classical objects, then sure you can, you know, mimic the algebra, but there would be no quantum mechanical content. Because in a sense here I'm allowed to end up not in one of the two fusion channels, but in superposition of two. And that's when it becomes interesting. Yeah, so
maybe I can add one thing to this question about truncation. So what you want is you want to deform the spins to get something which is not fermion bosa. So you want something which have a solution to Young-Best equation where you don't get symmetrical anti-symmetric solution. You can do that easily, and then the problem you lose unitarity. So now you want to get back to unitarity, so you need something you hold back to the only positive norm, not something with a negative norm. And that's the constraint given the truncation. If you don't truncate, you get something with a negative norm or zero norm. This is called a positive energy condition. So if you mathematically you loop group representation, if you want a positive norm, they have to truncate.
So let me try to use the notion of quantum dimension. And quantum dimension, once again, you may have heard the word, but it's just referring to the dimensionality of a fusion space. So basically, what I'm trying to do is to fuse the dimension of a fusion space, which is of huge number of anions, and I just sum over all identical anions, and I just sum over all possible outcomes. Then, in principle, this is sum over all possible C, so N A C 1 C 2 M A C 2 C 3, etc. So this quantity scales in the thermodynamic limit as a power of some number, and this number is known as the quantum dimension D A for the anion, and it really tells you what the dimensionality of the space is. And for example, if you ask yourself what the dimensionality for the sigma particles, and let me go back to the Bratelli diagram, you can actually see that it's the way of how many routes along this diagram you can take to get, to the final point, which is given by the adding of n anions. And you can see that, in fact, for adding every two sigmas, you acquire a pair of possibilities. Because whenever you add two sigmas, you sort of acquire an extra diamond, which gives you two possible ways of working. So for example, for the sigmas, the quantum dimension of sigma is, according to this, is square root of 2. So the quantum dimension of Fibonacci anion is actually the golden ratio. So, which is interesting because these are not integers, as you would expect for normal particles. In fact, for the Abelian anion, the quantum dimension is always 1. But if it's anything but 1, the theory is non-Abelian theory.
It's also irrational. The problem is not the P over Q or something. It's a square root Q.
Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't have a classical Q-ish analog. Right? So, But for example, if I simply added spin half, the quantum dimension would be 2. Because for adding every spin, I get 2 more possibilities. That's sort of adding spin half. Here it's square root of 2. Okay, so in fact, there are certain properties that I'm not going to talk about much. It turns out that this always has to be greater or equal than 1, and that's just the requirement of the unitarity of theory. And if it's 1, the theory or the particular type of anions are actually abelian anions. So this is a very good quantity to look at, just to say if anions are abelian or not. And the total quantum dimension, D, is actually the sum over all dimensions squared over all particles in the theory. So
that has to be an integer, right?
No,
even not.
So this one, sigma pi 1, this one, what is the total p?
For this, 2. Because you have 3 particles in that theory, 2 of them are perfectly abelian. So it's going to be, 1 plus 1 plus 2. So it's 2. That's if you include, so the total quantum dimension of that theory is. What?
No, just a question. D is not an integer always, so the global dimension D is not always an integer.
No, but here it is. But for example, it isn't for the Fibonacci anions, because there you just add 1 and the square root of the golden ratio, and you don't get back anything integer out of that.
Can I ask not like this? Well, how can I understand that this quantum dimension is related to the physical size of the physical Hilbert space of the anions?
Well, in some sense, I just defined it that way.
So how is it related to the Hilbert space, size of Hilbert space of anions? Is it related as
well? I'm not certain I understand the question.
I think it's just the Wollinder's formula. If you want to compute the dimension of the Hilbert space, there's a formula given by Wollinder from string theory.
Uh-huh.
And those numbers just come into the
right.
Cell.
So
is there
for example, if I start with spin up and then just truncate everything and then above there and just count the Hilbert space there, that Hilbert space dimension can be related to that big V.
Yeah, there's a little bit of expansion, but basically, first I should say the truncation is not that simple. It's not just you cut a line. Mm-hmm. That's the most difficult thing, because you need it's the function rule to be consistent. That's the most difficult thing to solve, the Pythagorean.
Mm-hmm. Every
Creole random equation, it's very difficult to solve the Pythagorean classically. If you can do that, basically you prove you can simulate quantum computer by classical computer. We know there are all quantum computers here. You get a solution, this is a quantum computer. So it's very difficult to truncate. But if you truncate and you want to ask certain Hilbert space, what's the dimension of this? And there's a very simple formula, just some numbers like the quantum dimension, you add them together, and you will get the dimension. So that's...
My impression is truncation is just 2j smaller equal to level 10.
That's for particular SU2 level.
Yeah, this is for this kind of theories. In principle, this is a simple kind of Bracelli diagrams. They don't always have to be like that. So
it's more complicated.
It's much more common. That's just this particular SU2 level K. You have this truncation which is given by this upper bound of 2K at the level.
So here you cannot write a clear truncating formula for this case.
For which case?
For this diagram, for this onion case. The truncation rule is more complicated.
What I'm saying is, if you want to think about conformal field theory, I know many people here know. So if you take a complete group, and you start to do the classical theory, then you ask, how do I get a closed theory truncated?
Yeah.
It's not as simple as just, take a level and restrict it.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how you cut the, it's called a width space, how you cut the width space so that you get some reflection to back to the chamber. So it's not just a single cut. Mm-hmm. Here it's just a simple because this theory is very special. Mm-hmm. This theory is called singular generated, which means every irreducible comes from spin half, mm-hmm. and then tensor, the power comes from there. So you just have a single cut.
Okay.
But if you have more generators, then you have several lines to cut. So it's very long.
So let me actually, without comments, to to sort of develop this diagrammatic way of thinking a little bit further. First of all, and unfortunately I don't already have time to do that in details. So when I said that I associate this picture with the state, in fact I can make it equal to that, but I need to, so there is some little subtlety to that. What I need to do is I need to think of this state as this picture times a coefficient, which is the fourth root of dc dA dB, and the same thing is here, of course. And the reason why this coefficient arrives, and the reason why quantum dimensions actually get in, which is not trivial at all, because you know the way I defined it through the dimensionality of the fusion space, actually comes from the requirement that what I want to do is I want to be able to actually bend my lines around. And in particular, one thing I should be able to do is do this kind of thing, where you can think of taking, you know, a particle B, fusing it with B bar, or I can put an arrow here, to produce a vacuum particle and so on. And when you start looking at, you know, what happens to your fusion space, you actually have to, in order for the product, for the, you know, for the inner product to be normalized, you actually need this coefficient if you allow yourself to bend lines. So I'm not deriving that for you, but this has immediate consequences. In particular, what I can do is I can construct, as I mentioned, an object like this, which is C A B C prime, and what I realize is that this is nothing but up to a coefficient, which is sitting here, an inner product of these two states. So what I did is I took anion C prime, broke into A and B, and then combined them back into C prime, which is, according to this, is just the inner product of that. And this is nothing but delta C C prime, and then this coefficient dA, dB, dC, C. And that by itself has a consequence, and that is if I took C and C prime to be a vacuum charge, then this picture, A bar, combined to the vacuum charge, which I'm just going to drop out, the value of this diagram is equal to dA. So that's another way of thinking of quantum dimension when you start drawing diagrams. This is simply a value that you can assign to a circle, the amplitude of having this circle. Okay.
How do I actually, what is sigma bar? Does it exist?
Sigma bar is sigma, because you're talking about this example. Because remember, I had relations where, you know, sigma cross sigma is equal to 1 plus psi. Yeah. So sigma bar is the one that can give me 1 as the outcome. So I just look at this and I see that the only particle that can be combined with another sigma to give 1 is yet another sigma. So this is the example when A and A bar of sigma and sigma bar is the same possible. The same is true with Banach anions. So it doesn't mean that A and A bar can only give you 1.
Yeah.
All right. So now, so do I have like 10 more minutes? Can you guys tolerate me for that long? Because I actually want to get to actually getting some answers out of this. I spent so much time setting the language.
No, but completely maths.
What?
We want to get some physics.
Yeah. So, okay. So I should erase as much as I can.
So is there any particular sense to the way that you put down the arrows here?
except the natural verb.
So I just put an arrow down to indicate a bar, just to indicate the fact that they can arise. Well, in principle, when I do these diagrams, what can I erase arrow in this case? Sure. If they combine to nothing, then yes. But in principle, for an arbitrary anion theory, this is not equal to that. You know, this is a bar, and so what you know, what you're asking whether I can always do that, the answer is no. If it happens that the anti-anion is equal to the anion itself, then you can.
So for all days, if they are mirror up, so they are not direct like a mirror runner, then you're fine.
Well, in fact, in this theory, every particle is its own conjugate. Because, you know, for the other, so this is 1 plus psi, psi times psi is actually 1, so that one is also its own conjugate. So in this particular theory, there are no problems, but if I'm considering a broad class of theories, then no, in general, I can't. All right? So, one thing I didn't do is I didn't talk about braiding, and that's what I started talking about. And so, let me also introduce, so what does braiding do? So, braiding, naturally, I erased all the pictures. After all, talking about anions was talking about braiding. So, braiding, if you remember, was doing this. So, this was my braiding operation on two lines. Now I want to actually apply that to my states in my fusion space. So that means actually combining that, with my state like this. And in principle, I can now think of this. So this is nothing but R A B applied to the state A B C, so C A B. Now I'm dropping the coefficients, sort of picture-wise, this should be equal to sum of some coefficients, which you would call R C A B. Pictures like this, B A C. So this tells me that I can redraw a picture like this as a sum of pictures of that kind, where I need to know these matrices. It turns out that these matrices R, A, B, C are not independent from the F moves. There is an even uglier equation than the pentagon equation that is called the hexagon equation, which just to save time, I'm not drawing. Which is yet another consistency relation, which tells you that in principle, not all possible results of braiding two anions can come out for a given set of fusion rules. Well, fusion rules put constraints on the F symbols, and then in turn they put constraints on the R symbols. So the fusion rules and the braiding rules are actually not independent of each other. Now, I just wanted to make one comment, and there was a question about Young-Baxter equation. So the Young-Baxter equation is actually easy to draw. It's yet another consistency relation that you can have when you start braiding the particles. It looks pictorially like this. And it's once again it's actually equivalent to the relation for the braid group that I had before. So, but now this has to be consistently applied there. So now what I'm going to there is sort of another important property of this matrices R, which relate these quantities to the topological spins of the particles. And that can be, so this is Young-Buxter equation. But I'm not going to use it explicitly. So the property for the so the property that relates these R matrices to topological spins can be written like this. So it's that R A B C squared is equal to theta C theta A theta B. And let me just tell you what these thetas are. These thetas are the factors that you get by twisting the particle itself. So it's literally, if you want to relate that to a spin, theta is equal to e to the I pi 2 pi I s, where s is the spin of a particle. So that tells you how the state transforms under the rotation of a particle by itself. And this picture actually has a pictorial representation, because if you start with C and then twist these particles twice, so what you can do is you can slide this twist down the line to C. But what will happen is that you will get, so you have to be careful thinking about a line twisting around itself. So what you should be really thinking about is twisting a ribbon. So if you can come up with this way of fusing particles coming from a ribbon, and it's sort of a simple thing, except for I don't have a ribbon to show how it's literally done, what you will get is you will get something like this. So this is done by simply sliding this down the twist down this thing. And so these are the factors that are associated with the spin, with what happens to the particle when you what happens when you do the twist. And that's the relation that we have.
So I can think of this some kind of non-abelian base space.
I'm sorry?
Can I think of this as some kind of non-abelian base space?
Well, these are actually just phases. Because you know, if you simply twist a particle around itself, you don't deserve abelian or non-abelian. You don't deserve anything else but a phase. So otherwise, your theory would immediately be non-unitary.
So these are actually all two spins, not all three spins.
These are conformal spins, if you wish. So you know, actually, I'm always confused whether this or this is called conformal spin. I think this is called conformal. Dimension, right?
So that's scaling, that's the concept, scaling dimension.
Yeah, scaling dimension.
So this is just experimental scaling.
I see.
And then the Brainian and the non-Brainian Barry phase. So the Brainian matrix is the other.
But this is what you do to a single particle. You don't, you know, it's not a property of. All right, so as I said, there are lots and lots of consistency conditions that, you know, so as you see that, for a given set of R's, not all topological spins are allowed, and so on. So you actually, if you actually sit down and start asking yourself what theories are allowed, it turns out that, you know, they're heavily constrained by all these consistency conditions. Now, so I spent all this time talking about this quantity, but let me just show how to do a simple diagram, and maybe that will be And then I'll talk about what it has to do with interferometric experiments, because as I said, unfortunately, I spent too much time setting the language and haven't spent any time telling, you know, how to use it for anything useful. All right? So let me erase this, although I do like this. So there is one useful diagram that I might want to calculate. And this useful diagram is actually, so-called, it's a very important quantity. It's called topological S matrix. And it's defined as 1 over D. So actually the direction of arrows is different papers define it slightly differently, but we should just stick to one definition. So it's this object for particles A and B. And on one hand, I can use the R moves. So what I can always do is I can fuse. So what I can do thinking about this object is first use the F move on these two lines, which allows me to think about this as this object so this is done by using an F move in A and B, that is making it equivalent to that. So there is some C involved, it will be some over C. And in fact, this quantity, if I now calculate it using that property, it turns out that it's, well, you know, initially there is 1 over D. It turns out that it's just D to the minus 1, well, it's 1 over capital D, sum over all possible fusion channels for A and B, A, B, C, theta C divided by theta A, theta B, D, C. So this is what this matrix element is equal to. And let me just give you the example of what it is, for example, for various quantities that for the three different fields that enter the simple easing theory. So the matrix itself has this form. So this is the quantity that, well, has been calculated for many matrices, but in principle, knowing this is not difficult. I mean, assuming you know the scaling dimensions of all the fields, you can always calculate that. So, I'm sorry? There was N, A, B, C. So it's well, for this theory, it's either 1 or 0. It's how many independent fusion channels you have for particles A and B. So in what happens here? So how many ways do you have of combining A and B into particle of type C? And then you have R squared, and so I already erased the equation that generates this quantity, and that's it. Okay? So let me just write down the answer for this topological S matrix for the anion theory, for the easing anion theory, and then I'll give a very brief comment about what it's equal to. So let me just say that SAB, and I'm not putting coefficient there, I'm just saying that it's, so there is actually some Abelian coefficient, but it's actually this. So what this tells me is, so the particles are labeled, of course, 1, sigma, and psi, 1, sigma, and psi, and that tells me what is the what is that object for these particles. Now, what I really want to comment about is this 0, which is actually a very important feature, as it turns out, and the interferometric experiments are actually well tuned to probe various matrix elements in this particular matrix. The reason why this happens to be zero can be actually traced back from this expression. If I just think about what happens if A and B particles are both are sigma particles. Now, we remember that there are two ways of fusing them. it's 1 and psi. 1 is a boson, the other one is a fermion. So for this particular case, I would get 1 over d, which I'm not specifying, because we know it's actually 1 half. And now I have two terms in this expression for two sigma particles. One of them is sigma for a for the vacuum field divided by sigma theta sigma squared, and the dimensionality of that is 1, right? And then there is another term, and the other term is plus 1/2 theta for the psi particle, which actually happens to be minus 1. This particle is actually a fermion. And remember, theta is e to the 2 pi I spin, and spin for a fermion is a half. So this quantity and that quantity simply cancel each other, and that is what we see in here. And you can simply track sort of the rest of the entries in this matrix by doing this. So now, what does this quantity have to do with reality? So let me now spend the remaining minus 5 minutes telling what this will have to do with reality, hopefully. So let me think about a quantum hole bar, which I will draw like this. So the hatched region is the region where I have my incompressible quantum hole liquid. And let me put an antidote in the middle where I can hope to store some anions, trap some anions by electrostatic potential. And what I'm hoping to do is to look at so I assume that everything inside the hole bar is gapped. Now, and I'm running current, so you know that's going to be the edge current running, chiral edge current running here, and then the opposite current running here. And now if I bias the two edges with respect to each other, there will be more current going one way than the other, and that will, you know, sort of the difference between the number of channels going to the right and to the left will give me the quantized hole conductivity in this case. But now what happens if I have the two constrictions? If I have these two constrictions, there is a possibility of current actually leaking back onto itself. So that actually results in the deviation of the quantized hole conductivity, or conductance, I should say, from its quantized value. Or alternatively, you can say that this results in appearance of rho xx, Rxx, you know, if you're an experimentalist who measures that. Now, naturally, if you have two channels with the tunneling amplitudes T1 and T2, what you will see is the superposition of these two currents. And now we can try to think about the way of representing. So I want to say that Rxx is going to be proportional to T1 squared plus T2 squared plus whatever two real parts of T1, T2 star. And then there will be actually if these were abelian anions, then you would also have to include the Aronov-Bohm phase that is picked by a particle traveling along this path compared to the particle going along that path. On the other hand, if these are non-abelian anions, then you can actually convince yourself rather simply that what enters here, so there will be some abelian phase no matter what, and I'll call it e to the I alpha. This is the real part of all of that. But if you think about what happens is you look at the superposition, so you know the antidote actually has some non-abelian charge stored on it, right? well, you know, assuming I can trap a certain number of quasi-particles, they may come with some non-abelian charge associated with that. And now what I'm doing is I'm actually taking one of my particles around. So, you know, this is just sort of, you know, time propagates upwards, and I'm trying to visualize what happens here. So whatever sits here is just the anionic, the line corresponding to the anionic charge on the antidot. And this corresponds to the line, being taken, sort of anion being taken around. And now I have to sandwich that with another state where the anion was not taken around, which is just that kind of state. And when I sandwich them together, you can think of sort of gluing the ends of these two pictures, I actually end up with this diagram, which I just presented to you over there. So the quantity that enters here is actually proportional to SAB, where A is the type of anion that goes around the edge and B. So this is A and this is B. B is whatever trapped there. And now you see what all that has to do with, hopefully has to do with interferometry for the non-abelian particles. That is, if you manage to get an odd number of quasi-particles, this unpaired Majorana modes, trapped on the island, so remember that the fusion rule for the odd number of these particles, so whenever you fuse odd number of sigmas, you always end up in a sigma state. The non-abelian label corresponding to that is sigma. And now the question is, but what are the particles tunneling around? So how do I know it's the other particles of type sigma, for example, and not electrons, not psi particles, whatever they are in the quantum Hall language? Well, that is actually a slightly tricky question. It doesn't have an immediate obvious answer. What you have to do is you have to look at the scaling dimension for the tunneling operator for different types of particles and see which one wins in this particular case. So it's not the question that you can answer on the spot, but something that we learned from what Shogun Wen did in the early 90s is that typically it's the lowest charge particle that has the highest scaling dimension, whose tunneling operator has the highest scaling dimension.
Lowest
scaling dimension, therefore the highest probability. Which in this case, if I now ask myself, what are, for example, the charges associated with that? So a sigma particle actually carries charge E over 4. So this is the lowest charged particle, and it has the lowest scaling dimension, therefore it has the highest amplitude of tunneling. So therefore, you can hold that if you build this device and you manage to trap the particle of type, an odd number of quasi-particles on the island so that the net fusion channel corresponds to sigma, and the particles that that can tunnel are also sigma, so you don't want to bring these points too close to each other, because then your scaling argument just goes out of the window. Well, first of all, scaling is relevant, so if you bring them too close to another, you actually try to pinch off the contact. But as long as you're careful to keep them far apart, then you can hope that only sigma particles tunnel. And then what you see is that you are picking this particular element of the matrix, which is 1, which tells you that whenever there is an odd number of quasi-particles on that island, you actually get nothing.
This is assumed that you can selectively prepare your alpha with A running around the HP around the antibody. So then.
But here's what I'm discussing. First of all, B, I hopefully, well, not I, but whoever attempts to do that, can hopefully, well, these particles are charged. So presumably, you can hope to use some capacitance, so you have this antidote of very low capacitance so that you can easily control the net charge by some gate voltage above, and if your control is fine to the point that you can attract charge in the units of E over 4, then you can hope to be able to get an odd number of these particles there, right?
Okay.
But what A particles are is really determined by what tunnels. And I just gave an argument for why we might expect sigma particles to tunnel rather than anything else.
So suppose you can use the gate to control B, right? And you can resist the measurement. But you cannot control the edge that you say that our A particle are going there.
What do you mean by not being able to control it?
I just try to understand this concept. Now you say the resistance is a function of A and B. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, through this.
But when you do the experiment, you have some over all the
No, because I just gave the argument that only sigma particles, only A equals, so A equals sigma simply because these are the ones that tunnel with the highest probability.
Okay.
It's a scaling argument.
Yeah, it's a scaling argument.
The smallest scaling
and what B is equal to really depends on how much charge you brought onto
onto the
island.
At the end, the resistance is a function of B.
Yeah.
Which is you can control it through the gradient.
Right. So, and that's it. So you see the nature of the even odd effect directly from this expression and by sort of eyeballing this matrix, because the important entries are these entries. As long as we chose the A particle to be of type sigma, then if there is an even number of quasi-particles on island B, then you either pick this value or that value from the matrix. So you do have this term in there. On the other hand, although the sign is in the overall sign of this term, well, you know, aside from all this a billion junk that goes in that you really don't have much control of, the sign is determined also by the overall fusion channel. But as long as you're in the odd regime, you get nothing. And there is a sort of the idea due to Addis Turner, I guess, and Bert Halpern of how to see if you have anything. So there are several ways that you can think of, but I think the most beautiful one is proposed by them, is you actually sort of create a small gate above this sample, and then you just start messing with the edge. And if you start messing with the edge by, I don't know, applying some AC voltage, then you naturally mess with the Aronoff-Bohm phase that gets into this by simply, you know, after all, these are charged particles going around the region of the magnetic field, so there is always an Aronoff-Bohm phase associated with that. And you're messing with this, so if this term is non-vanishing, then you see the result of messing up with the edge in your RxX measurement. On the other hand, if this is zero, then whether or not you mess with the edge is not going to show up, because this term is just not there. So that's how one may hope to actually check for the even odd effect. So I'll just quickly throw the S matrix for the other theory that I mentioned, the Fibonacci anion. It's actually 1, 1, 1 epsilon, where epsilon is the, sorry, 1 over epsilon squared. It's 1 divided by the square of the golden ratio, which is roughly 1/3. So you don't get a drastic, so once again, you can make the argument that the particle with the low, so this presumably has something to do with the other quantum Hall state, which is 12/5. And they can make the same scaling argument that it's the particle of this epsilon type that has the lowest scaling dimension, therefore that's the one that will tunnel. And so there you don't have such a drastic even odd effect in the sense of completely killing off interference, but you do have a suppression. So this, if I remember correctly, this number is something like 0.38. So it's not much, but perhaps detectable. So I just want to mention two more words, sentences. And that is, first of all, aside from being hopefully useful to detect non-abelian anions, this is also a way potentially to read out the result of some topological quantum computation, if we ever manage to build a topological quantum computer. Because after all, the information in a topological quantum computer is ideally stored in the overall fusion channel of your anions. That is, in whatever the total anion charge B you happen to have in certain region in space. So as you can see, this type of experiment is actually sensitive to what B is through this very expression, through, because it's actually probing the entries in the topological S matrix. So that's one thing in particular. There is this proposed qubit by Dasarma and Chaden, Nayak, and Mike, which looks very much like the quantum hole bar that I just presented to you, except for now it has two antidotes. And the idea is to actually keep a sigma particle here and a sigma particle here. And now this is a qubit because these two have two possibilities for the two possible fusion channels. That is, the two can be either fused into a boson or a fermion. And how to measure what they're fused to is by performing the this interferometric experiment around both of them, and hopefully the difference between two fusion channels is here, one and minus one. So it's the minus sign that you should be able to pick, which is probably difficult, but not impossible. And then the idea of actually switching there is NOT gate is tunneling a single quasiparticle here. And the way to understand why it switches the overall fusion channel can also very easily be understood from drawing this diagram. So unfortunately, I spent all the time setting the language and sort of none of the time using it. But sort of the advantage of setting this language is then you can calculate quantities. For example, you can answer the question of what happens when you tunnel a quasiparticle between these two is a bridge. You just draw another diagram and manipulate that diagram using the R and F rules, and you immediately get the answer that, in fact, you just switched from one fusion channel to another by doing that. So I think I should let you go at this point. I do apologize for taking so much time, and I do thank the survivors.
One question. So it seems to me you're describing free theory, it's like free particle theory, right? How about the interactions, since anions carry charge, we're watching your picture?
So in principle, in this case, not in an obvious way. Well, look, I mean, for example, here, as long as I keep the particle, so what you're discussing now is energetics, right? So the energetics is definitely there, but it's not there in an obvious way. Because, for example, if I fuse these two particles, each of them charge E over 4, I can still get either a boson or a fermion of charge E over 2. So which one I get is independent on the... So the energetics does not get messed with the fusion rules, for example, if that was your question. So in principle, you're right. I mean, these sigma particles are charged objects. So if I wanted to study the energetics and dynamics, I would have to remember that. But it does not affect anything in the algebra that I set.
So you want everything to be far away.
Yeah. So ideally, of course, you want to you want to minimize this. Well, the energetics gets in sort of less obvious ways, of course. In principle, if you ask yourself, if you bring two sigma particles onto a single island, and ask yourself, well, I have two fusion channels, but do these two fusion channels actually have the same energy? Yeah. And the answer is no, and I can give you two reasons for that. Reason number one is that, you know, you can actually, Nick Reed and his graduate student, Milicha Milovanovic, wrote a paper where they actually explicitly wrote down wave functions. So you can read off wave functions for both this and that. And well, these are different wave functions, and if you calculate the Coulomb energy associated with these wave functions, then, you know, my bet will be different. So there is one reason, and second reason, these two have different conformal spins, and since they have different conformal spins, they also have different kinetic energy. So there are two, at least two places where the energetics gets in. But actually both energetic contributions will go down at least as 1 over L with the size of the island. So there is a hope of minimizing that effect. And that's why, for example, for this qubit, these guys, instead of storing two particles on the same island, they store them on two well-separated islands. And in this case, you can make an argument that the energy difference between the two fusion channels will be exponentially small rather than any power of. Did that answer the question?
So for the quantum dimension, the Fibonacci cases, an easy way to see that you get the golden mean.
So there is a combinatoric way, right, of seeing.
It's easy. You just you have tau square equal 1 plus tau. Just solve that equation, you will get the golden mean.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's an axiom. You just take the fusion rule, you change everything to a number, then you solve them, then they will become the quantum dimension. So just treat the fusion rule as numbers, you will get a quantum dimension.
Oh yeah, this is actually something I didn't mention, but you can always feed quantum dimensions instead of the particles back in, and it works always, and you know it works because of you know, because we talk about the dimensionality of the fusion spaces. For example, in this case, square root times square root, you know, root 2 times root 2 is 1 plus 1. So for the
Fibonacci case, you just have the expression.
Yeah, for the Fibonacci case, you have the expression which I erased, which was whatever it was. You call it tau, I call it epsilon, right? But it doesn't matter. So, you know, epsilon times epsilon is equal to 1 plus epsilon. And, you know, this is actually the equation for the golden mean. So if you replace that by just quantum dimensions, so this is d squared is equal to 1 plus d. That's the equation that gives you.
And why can I just put in the...
Well, that actually follows from the definition, because if you ask yourself how you combine the... So imagine you have, you know, you already fused lots of particles in this state, epsilon, and lots of particles in this state of epsilon. Each of them has a quantum dimension associated with that, which is literally the dimensionality of the space. And then you ask yourself, you know, how can I combine these two spaces into a new, bigger fusion space? And it's just a counting argument.
So I guess, in a way, you can interpret the fusion rule as a tensor product of the Hilbert space.
Well, the problem is the Hilbert space doesn't have a tensor product structure.
But asymptotically, you do. Asymptotically. I know, for a finite number of the...
So I was actually trying to avoid the tensor
discussion. I know, because for a specific number of quantum particles, you cannot...
Oh, yeah,
but asymptotically, this works
right.
out, actually.
Right, but I don't know what a tensor product of irrational dimensionality.
Yeah, I know, but
it's fine. You can take this exactly as the tensor product of the Hilbert space, and the only problem here is if you take the trace, it's not the normal trace, which is the dimension, it's the quantum dimension.
Right. No, but what I can do is I can always treat this as some kind of iterative. Thing. So if I already fused a bunch of
But that's the same. I mean, the iteration procedure is the same as the tensor product of the Hilbert space, I think. But now actually I understand how this works out now. At least that's how I would like to understand.
All right, and I do apologize for bringing too much math into little physics.
No, it was great. I like it.
First time I think I understood something from it.